Good afternoon. It's a very rough start at the Martin House today. I got up to make coffee and our coffee maker broke. Yeah, you may not think that's a big deal, but it's a pretty big deal at our place. So I had to go to Dunkin' Donut to get two large coffees. $5.86 for two large coffees. So I guess after sunset at some point this evening, we'll be heading to Walmart to rectify that situation. Nobody cares, I know. I didn't expect you to care. No big deal. Just be glad you won over this morning. There was a, when I was growing up as a teenager and in my 20s, even into my 30s, I don't remember ever listening to any classical music and never really thought a whole lot about it. And then one year when I was living in California, they on the radio, one of the radio stations in California, they had where the listeners could write in, and they had what they called the original top 40. So they took all the people that wrote in. I was in the Los Angeles area at the time, and they ranked them 1 through 40, and they started at 40. And if you know anything about classical music, a lot of the pieces are most of the pieces are over 30 minutes, some quite a bit longer than that. But So I thought I would listen to some of it, and actually what I did, I recorded it. It lasted for about 2 days, and because it takes, you know, there's so much, 40 of them. And I started listening to the pieces, and I was amazed how good and how much I enjoyed a lot of it. Now, classical music, you know, they're pieces that I don't know why anybody would ever listen to. But then you look at modern music, and then, you know, they're beautiful pieces, and then there are pieces that I don't know why anyone would ever listen to. But again, some of it's personal preference, but some of it is just, I think you know what I'm talking about. But when I was listening to this original Top 40, there was one piece by a composer. His name was Antonio Vivaldi. And he lived back in the 1700s, and he was the court chapel master in a town in Italy. And he wrote a piece entitled The Four Seasons. Now, you may have never heard that. You may be very familiar with it. But what it is, it's a piece where he goes through, I think it lasts about 40 minutes, and he goes through the four seasons of the year and has a little separate movement for each one. He starts with spring, then summer, then fall, then winter. And I thought what I would do, now this is going to be a two-part sermon. Now, I won't be back, I'm not on the schedule here again until late January, July. I must have really made Mr. Beam mad if it's July. but anyway, it's January is what I meant to say. And even though it's a two-part sermon, you don't have to, they don't both have to go together within a week or two, so it'll be just fine. But what I wanted to do is take a look at the four seasons as in the four seasons of the life of a Christian. So there's spring, there's summer, there's fall, there's winter in the life of a Christian. And I think you'll see the analogy as we go forward. I'll probably cover the first two of them today, and then I have a split sermon in later part of January, which I'll cover the last two. But one thing I really enjoy about living here, and also I enjoyed, you know, growing up in Tennessee, that there are four seasons of the year. You know, I've lived in a number of different places. I lived in New Orleans, and there's just one long season. It seems like they're sort of the same way in Florida, but it had good points, but I think you'll see as we go along, a life of a Christian can parallel the four seasons of the year and the four seasons of a Christian life. Now, first, I wanted to turn back to Timothy. First Timothy chapter 1. Just read a couple of verses or three verses to, or sets of verses to set the stage here. So here's Paul, you know, 1st and 2nd Timothy were two of the last letters he wrote, probably more than likely, almost certainly, 2nd Timothy was the last letter Paul wrote. But in 1st Timothy chapter 1, Paul admonishes Timothy, and all Christians for that matter, to be aware of something in verse 18 through 20, 1 Timothy 1. Paul says, this charge I commit to you, son Timothy. So Timothy was a younger man. I don't know how, what his age was, but Paul was an elder statesman, I guess you could say, because he was near the end of his life physically. And he's trying to prepare Timothy and other Christians for their career. I don't know if that'd be the proper term, but for their life as a Christian. And Timothy, his life as an elder in the church of God. So he says, this charge commend you, son Timothy, according to the prophecies previously made concerning you, Timothy, that he had said from time to time. And here's what Paul wanted Timothy to know, that you, by them, you may wage the good warfare. So the life of a Christian, in some ways, you can compare it to warfare, because there's scriptures that we are at war against Satan. We're at war against evil spirits. We're at war against all types of things that are not profitable or not right. And so Paul's trying to get Timothy to realize the importance of this. Having faith, this is what Paul wants Timothy to remember, and a good conscience. And how many in the church of God over the, just going back for the last, 50, 60 years, how many have seared their conscience, whether they be an elder or a deacon or a member or whatever the case may be? Of course, all deacons and elders are members. We're all together in this, but he's trying to get Timothy to be serious, and I'm assuming that Timothy was very serious, but he wanted Timothy to have a good conscience, which some, having rejected what? They rejected their conscience. You know, when people hear things that are heresy, real heresy, you would have to think that at first they knew something wasn't right. But how many people just went along with the flow over the years? So having rejected, and because of this, their faith have suffered shipwreck. They just basically, I guess you could say, fell off the boat. Of whom, and he mentions two people, Hymenaeus and Alexander, whom I delivered to Satan that they may learn not to blaspheme. So they could have come back. Who knows what happened to them, but they caused Paul a lot of problems. Now, going over to 2 Timothy, just setting the stage here. Going over to 2 Timothy chapter 2. Again, the last letter that Paul wrote before he was martyred, or he died a martyr's death. 2 Timothy chapter 2, I'm going to read verse 1 through 7. Again, he's talking to Timothy. He says, you therefore, my son, be strong in the grace that is in Christ Jesus. Encouraging Timothy to be strong. Don't waver. And the things that you have heard from me among many witnesses, commit these to faithful men who will be able to teach others also. You must endure hardship as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. So again, he's comparing the life of a Christian to being in a battle, a war, and we are in a war against evil and against wrong things. No one engaged in warfare entangles themselves with the affairs of this life. Well, of course, we have our life. We have things we have to deal with, like our coffee pot breaking today. That was a bad one. But that was a joke. Just lighten up. I didn't mean that seriously. But no one engaged in warfare entangles himself with the affairs of this life. We have things. We have jobs. I've been working. Have a good friend that I grew up, I worked with for years in healthcare, and he's the materials manager at the two hospitals in Decatur, and he's asked me several times if I would work, if I wanted to work some, and I retired, but I still, you can't want to do some things. So right now, I'm only going to be working part time, probably a couple of days a week. But right now, I'm working 5 days a week, from 7 in the morning, actually from like 6:30 in the morning to noon, and I'm enjoying it, as knowing that I won't have to do this, on and on and on, but I have no idea why what that has to do with this sermon. But anyway, so you know that I'm working 5 days a week from 6:30 to 12. You don't care, but I do. And man, that's why I need coffee in the morning. But so no one engaged in warfare entangles himself or herself with the affairs of this life, that he or she may please him who enlisted him or her as a soldier. We are a soldier of Jesus Christ, of God the Father. And also, if anyone competes in athletics, he's not crowned unless he competes according to the rules. The hardworking farmer must be first to partake of the crops. Consider what I say, and may the Lord give you understanding in all things. He wants Timothy to be strong. Now, dropping down to verse 14, and then I'll get into the meat of the sermon. Okay, verse 14, remind them of these things. He's telling Timothy to do this. Charging them before the Lord not to strive about words to no profit, to the ruin of the hearers. You know, we can argue about things that just really don't matter. Now, there are things that are pivotal. You know, there's things that matter, but then there's other little things that really don't matter. They're not doctrines. They're just ideas and thoughts and ways of doing things. He says, be diligent to present yourself approved to God. Again, he's talking to Timothy, but he's also talking to you and me. A worker who does not need to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. He says, Timothy, shun profane and vain babblings, for they will increase to more ungodliness. We see it in the world. Things in our society that are supposedly, they're put out as if they are good when they're evil. There's things going on in our society. There are things going on here in the United States that are flat out evil. And we have to call it for what it is. We have to call it for what it is. And you see it. You know, I mean, it's hard to watch the news sometimes. Now, you can be too much of a news junkie. But I do like to watch, you know, keep in touch with what's going on. And some of the things that are being put forward as normal are absolute total perversions. You know it and I know it. And yet it will be kept throwing at us as if we are the problem because we don't agree with some of these weird things that are going on. So he said, shun profane and vain babblings. They're going to increase. And their message will spread like a cancer. Now, some of the things that are going on in this world that you look at and you think, why can't anybody believe that? But yet, it spreads like a cancer, doesn't it? It's just filth. He talks about these two men, Hymenaeus and Philetus again, who have strayed concerning the truth. They left the truth. They said the resurrection's already passed. Well, how can anybody buy that the resurrection was already passed? But evidently some were. And they overthrew the faith of some. Nevertheless, the solid foundation of God stands. God's truth never changes. It never changes. The Lord knows those who are His. And let everyone who names the name of Jesus Christ depart from iniquity. But in a great house, they're not only vessels of gold and silver, but of wood and clay, some for honor and some for dishonor. Now, I could read on. I could really read to the end of this chapter. But let me just read one other verse. Verse 23. Avoid foolish and ignorant disputes, knowing that they generate strife. We're not talking about the laws of God. We're talking about things that really, quite frankly, are personal preferences. Now, this does not really fit the analogy exactly, but, you know, I talked about classical music. I don't listen to classical music all the time, but I do listen to it. And I had nothing. I had no idea about classical music till I listened to some of the I guess you could say, famous pieces, some of the more popular pieces, but some of it's wonderful and some of it's just pure junk. But yet, that's what we see in this world. I remember when I was growing up in high school, living in Nashville, Tennessee, I started listening to the radio on Sundays especially, and I'd listen to these programs like Billy Graham, and I would listen to others. There are several others, and I found the World Tomorrow broadcast on, and I knew something was different because I knew there was something. And you know, when I started attending church, it was several years later because I went to college. I didn't attend church when I was in college. But I always had in the back of my mind, but then I started studying more, and I guess God brings you along as you're ready. And but when I came to church, I didn't come because of prophecy. Now, prophecy is very important. I'm not in any way trying to diminish that. But I didn't come because of prophecy. I came because of the Sabbath and plus the laws. And I just, but I find it interesting to me that I really didn't really put together a lot of the prophecy. Now, that's not better or worse. Prophecy is very important, but all of God's laws. And I started, you know, as a high school, I started receiving all these tracts and these various religious denominations. And I, they would send me these tracts to hand out. You've seen them, these little couple page things to tell you how, you know, to be saved and things like that. And I would get those, and I was a teenager, and I would go down to downtown Nashville. I was going to pass these out, but I felt so awkward. I never once, even though I tried, I never once handed one out. And in fact, I remember I would put one on a table in a store or something. I mean, I don't know what I was thinking, but I just felt awkward. I'm glad I didn't, but, you know, not that that would have made me awful if I had. But as I came to see the truth of God, it was both exciting and humbling. And I wanted others to see the truth, just like you did when you started hearing the truth. And I was perplexed that others didn't see what I saw. Now, none of my parents, none of my relatives, I don't have a single relative in the church of God that's ever been. And I had a good family. Penny would tell you how I have a very good family. Of course, most of my aunts and uncles are no longer alive. My parents are no longer alive. But I had a good family. But it was perplexing why others weren't attending a church. And then I started, I guess you could say, my life. You know, each of us have our own story to tell. But my life is a Christian. And I would compare my first stage of being a Christian to this piece, this Vivaldi piece, The Four Seasons, it was called, to the spring. And what would I call the spring of a Christian's life, whether it be me or you or any Christian? And I call that learning to wait on the kingdom. Learning to wait on the kingdom. Now, your first, I guess you could say the spring of your life as a Christian, it's a time of great enthusiasm. It's a time, quite frankly, of wanting everybody else to see what you see. And don't you wish everybody could see what we see? And you're enthusiastic, which is a wonderful thing, but it's frustrating when others don't see. I remember my parents, they were so concerned about me that I would, when I actually started later attending church, they were so concerned about me. They really were worried about me. And not because they were bad parents. They just worried about me. Now, what I think we all, and you know the scripture, but if you turn over to John 6, something that I probably should have known better or spent more time thinking about it. But when I was so concerned and wondering why all these other people did not see what I saw, and did not come to church and have the exact way of looking at things as I did, I think I'd have done better if I'd have considered John chapter 6, verse 44, a very famous scripture, you know it. No one, here's Jesus Christ speaking, no one can come to me unless the Father who sent me, who sent Jesus Christ, draws him or her. We can't just decide to be a Christian. Now, you can be a nominal Christian. You can be a different Protestant denomination. You can be a Catholic. You can be all that. You can come to the Church of God and attend, but you can't really become a Christian unless you start understanding. Start understanding what God is teaching. So no one can come to Christ unless the Father who sent me, Christ, draws him, and I'll raise him or her up at the last day. It's talking about eternal life. Well, you know, Paul talked later about those certain people in talking in Timothy's area that the resurrection had already taken place. Well, the last day has not come yet, has it? Remember once I had a funeral, and the lady that died, he was an elder, and his wife, of course, was an elder's wife, and he left the worldwide years ago, and he had his own organization. But when his wife died, he asked me if I would do the funeral, and I was happy to do it. I was happy to do it. And anyway, at the end of the funeral, there were several people that he knew that where he worked also. And he said that this one woman came up and said, "Don't worry about that guy up there," meaning me. "We know he doesn't know what he's talking about. We know your wife's in heaven." And he was laughing about it because he knew she wasn't in heaven. But here she was trying to comfort him. And said, "Don't worry about that guy up there, me. He doesn't know what he's talking about. Your wife's up in heaven." Well, it says he'll raise him up in the last day. So, what do you know? But it's amazing. She was trying to comfort him when really he knew that what I happen to be saying, or any true minister would be saying, that she was resting in the grave. Now, over in Luke, Luke chapter 9. So, Jesus Christ called his apostles, and he trained his apostles, and he gave them, you know, the truth, and they were out preaching the truth. But notice how, you know, different apostles, some of the apostles you don't read much about. You'll just see their name, and that's a couple of them. Basically, you only see their name when they list the apostles. And most of them, you only see them mentioned a few times. You see Peter a lot, James and John quite a bit, Andrew's in there several times, Philip, some of the others. But here is an interesting statement. Remember, these are the apostles. Jesus Christ has called them out, and they're out working and helping him. And notice what happens in Luke chapter 9. So in verse 51, Luke 9, "It came to pass when the time had come for him to be received up." In other words, this was the time when Jesus Christ was about to go back to Jerusalem to be arrested, to be beaten, and crucified. Not quite that time yet, but it's getting close to that time. "Came to pass when the time had come for him to be received up, that he steadfastly set his face to go to Jerusalem." He knew what was going to happen. He was prepared. "And he sent messengers before his face, and they went and they entered a village of the Samaritans to prepare for him. But they didn't receive him, because his face was set for the journey to Jerusalem." Now, when his disciples James and John saw this, when James and John saw that the Samaritan village were not giving Jesus Christ the proper respect, which they weren't, they were not happy. And they said, "Lord, here are new apostles." You know, they've been apostles, what, a year, two? I don't know. Not that long. They weren't seasoned Christians. And they said, "Lord, do you want us to command fire to come down from heaven and consume them just like Elijah did? Do you want to just wipe these people out because they're not showing you the proper respect," which of course they weren't. And he turned and he rebuked them and he said, "You don't know what manner of spirit you're of. You don't know what you are talking about. For the Son of Man," him, he said, "I didn't come to destroy men's lives. I didn't come to have fire come down from heaven to wipe physically people out physically. I came to save them." And he just went to another village. James and John, they were not bad people. They were great. They were excellent examples. We see John wrote letters of love, did he not? But yet, they were new. Now, I could turn, I won't, but I'll just quote Mark 3:17. Jesus Christ called them, James, John, the sons of thunder. The sons of, because they were so enthusiastic, but not necessarily in the right way. Called them the sons of thunder. Remember the first Feast of Tabernacles I ever went to. I went to the Feast of Tabernacles. I was living in New Orleans, and I went to the Feast of Tabernacles in St. Petersburg. It's 1973. And there were two other young men in our church, or my church area in New Orleans, that rode with me. So I drove most of the way, all the way maybe. And there were two other young men that went with me. One had a grandmother in the church. He didn't have his parents weren't in the church. And the other man was living at home with his parents who strongly disliked the church that he was attending. So they were very negative toward the Worldwide Church of God. So we went to St. Petersburg, over 10,000 people were in attendance. And I always remember this, and I don't know why this sticks in my mind so much, because as I was a new Christian, I've done all through my life, you make all kind of mistakes. But on the way to Feast of Tabernacles, we stopped somewhere. I have no idea what state, town, anything. We stopped to eat. And I ordered something. I don't remember the meal, except it had green beans in my meal. Yeah, green beans. Anytime you see the word country cooking, you know what I'm talking about. So one of the two young men who were new to, or they'd been attending longer than I had, but one of them said, you better check to make sure there wasn't any pork or lard in those beans. Not a bad statement, but when he said that, it was like, I probably should just said, yeah, okay, I'll check. But I said, no, everything's fine. Look, it's fine. And then both of them like, no, you better make sure there's no pork in those beans. When I grew up, my parents would always get these cans called pork and beans, remember? And you couldn't find the pork, but it's somewhere in there. But he said, you better check to make sure there's no pork in those beans. And I was too stubborn. I said, no. So you know what he did? He went back to the cook. And guess what? There was pork in those beans. Now, I didn't want to eat anything with pork in it. But I remember so clearly. I remember this so well. I could even see the table we were sitting at. And they talked to me about, I remember one of them specifically said, when you've been in the church a while like we have, you'll know how to handle these things better than you handle that. Now, I didn't handle it as well as I could have handled. I don't think I did it wrong. But I just remember them giving me this lecture about, when you've been around, you'll understand how it works. You just didn't handle that right. You could have eaten that. Again, of course you don't want anything cooked with pork or lard. But when we got to the feast, they talked so much about they were going to get the biggest this, the biggest that, biggest steak, at the feast. Neither one of them had much money. I didn't have a whole lot either, but I had more than they did. But you know what? The first 2 or 3 days of the feast, they lived like kings. They were getting steak. I mean, it was amazing. But after about 3 days, they both ran out of second tithe. And then they went to the pastor and asked for more second tithe, and he turned them down. And then I got to hear for the next 2 or 3 days how mean the pastor was for not giving them more second tithe. If they had budgeted things properly, they had plenty of tithe. You don't buy huge steaks every meal when you don't have the money. So they weren't bad guys, but both of them, they didn't stay in the church long at all. I don't think they were going even the next year. So the point is not that I did anything special, because I didn't. I was just a young guy trying to learn the truth. But yet, sometimes we need to think about what we say. Let's turn to Luke. Remember, this is the first phase, the phase of learning to wait on the kingdom. We've got all this enthusiasm because we're new to the truth, new to the faith. In Luke chapter 23, I don't think I thought a lot about this scripture at that time, but just in the point here, here's Jesus Christ to be crucified. And in verse 33 and 34 of Luke 23, interestingly, it says, and when they had come to the place called Calvary, there they crucified him. You can read right over that, but here is Jesus Christ, the Son of God, dying for the sins of the world. They crucified him, and the criminals, one on the right hand and the other on the left. And Jesus said, when he was being crucified, Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing. They didn't understand they were crucifying the Son of God. And they divided his garments and cast him. The people stood looking on. Even the rulers sneered, saying, he saved others, let him save himself if he's the Christ, the chosen. The soldiers mocked. They didn't really understand what they were doing, did they? Now I will briefly turn over to John chapter 1. John chapter 1. And David mentioned that, this scripture, part of it here. But all you have to do is read the first five verses of the Gospel of John, and it should strike me, it should strike you, this is something monumental. It says, verse 1, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. So Jesus Christ and God the Father were both God in the family of God. He was in the beginning with God, and all things were made through him. And without him, nothing was made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. And the light shines in darkness. And the darkness, it didn't comprehend it. They didn't understand what they're doing. Now, enthusiasm is a good thing. But enthusiasm must be mixed with patience and wisdom. So in the springtime of conversion is an exciting time, but it's only the beginning of a life as a Christian. I remember, I was a single young man, and I remember once and telling the pastor, I remember so clearly telling the pastor how they need to get control of all these kids and make sure these kids sit and listen and not blah, blah, blah. I mean, we all have to train our kids. That's not the point. But here, who was I to tell the pastor how to do everything? Well, I got my sort of my comments or whatever the word is a few years later. I remember when my daughter was about, I think she was 8 or 9, and my son was 4 years younger. So, maybe 9 and 5 or 6. And there was a church activity. Actually, it's Fred Keller's. He's not the first one, but this is Fred Keller's this time, so he won't mind me saying this. But there was an activity on a Saturday night, and my kids were having a good time, and I wasn't paying any attention to my kids. I was just having a good time. And Fred Keller's, who I love very much, he's a great guy, he asked me if he could talk to me for a minute about my kids. And I thought, this is going to really be good. And I remember... I won't mention the person's name, Hal's, because they don't attend anymore. You probably would know them. But he said, I just want to say something about your kids. Said, oh, yes. And he goes, your kids are totally out of control. You need to get a handle on your kids. Look at them running all over the place. That kind of hurt. But I'm glad he told me that. Because he was trying to help me. And my kids were probably kind of out of control. But point of the matter is, it wasn't mean. He was trying to help me. I was enthusiastic. Again, I'll say it one more time. The springtime of our conversion is an exciting time, but it's only the beginning of your or my life as a Christian. So let's also, in this sermon, look at the summer. And I call the summer of the life of a Christian is finding the strength to serve. Finding the strength to serve. Now let's take a look over in Mark. Mark chapter 6. Finding the strength to serve. Now here is scripture I'm sure you're aware of. It's called the feeding of the 5,000. So here's Jesus Christ feeding the 5,000. Verse 30. Let's read a few verses here. I won't comment too much on it. Just read it. Then the apostles gathered to Jesus, and he told him all things, both what they had done and what they had taught. So he had sent them out, preaching and teaching. So he had sent them out, and he said to them, come by yourselves to a deserted place and rest a while. For there were many coming and going. They didn't even know, they didn't even have time to eat. There are all these people. So they departed to a deserted place, in the boat by themselves, but the multitudes saw them departing, and many knew him. And they ran on foot from all these cities. They arrived before him. They came together, and Jesus, when he came out, he saw this great multitude, and he was moved with compassion because for they were like sheep that didn't have a shepherd. So he began to teach them. He began to teach them many things. Here's Jesus Christ talking to these men and women. And when the day was now far spent, his disciples came to him and said, this is a deserted place. It's already late. Send them away that they may go into the surrounding country and villages and buy themselves bread, for they have nothing to eat. Now, before I go further, remember right the first, they told them they were going to get in a boat and go away, but the people were thronging, so he came back. But he answered and said to them, you give them something to eat. And they said, well, shall we go and buy 200 denarii worth of bread and give them something to eat? And he said to them, well, how many loaves do you have? Go and see. And they went, and they found they had 5 loaves and 2 fish. And he commanded them to make them all sit down in the groups in green grass. So they sat down in ranks in hundreds and fifties. And when he had taken the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, he looked up to heaven. He blessed and broke the loaves and gave them to his disciples to set before them. And the 2 fishes he divided among them all. So they all ate and they were filled. And when they took up the 12 baskets full of fragments and the fish, now those who had eaten the loaves were about 5,000 men. I think one says 5,000 men plus women and children. That's a miracle, was it not? But what did the disciples say to him earlier? Send them away. We're tired. You're tired. You don't have time for this. But yet he found time. Would he ever feel that way in life? Do you ever just feel tired? Of course you do. Do you ever just feel tired of just the daily grind, what you need to do in life? Of course you do. I do. We all do. Do you ever feel like saying, as a Christian, just leave me alone? I would think we all do from time to time. Do you ever just want to rest and be left alone? But it's time to find the strength to serve. I know of a man who still attends church, lives in Georgia. He would drive from Rome, Georgia to Birmingham twice a month on Wednesday night for Spokesman's Club. It's about a 2.5-hour drive, if I'm not mistaken, one way, just to go to Spokesman's Club. Now, there's not enough members that are, you know, to really have a Spokesman's Club. I mean, it's not that we couldn't, but yet these days, you know, the church is not near as large as it used to be. But here was a man, he would drive 2.5 hours just to go to Spokesman's Club. Do you not think he would get tired at times? But he was wanting to learn. YU activities back in the day. How many of you would drive hours, hours and hours to work at an activity? And that was a good thing. But you know you would get tired at times. I know this one, he's no longer alive. He was assistant pastor in Nashville years ago. And he was assisting the pastor. And we used to have these men's basketball tournaments. We would have YOU basketball tournaments, men's basketball tournaments. And we would oftentimes, you know, I look forward to it. I know Nashville had an A team and a B team. I could probably figure out which one I was on. And Murfreesboro just had one team. And they came from various places, probably Huntsville, but Chattanooga would always sort of be the best team. And they weren't really too nice at times, were they? No, they were. They wanted you to know they were the best. They had a B team too. But I remember the assistant pastor. They had the tournament was in Chattanooga. It was actually, I believe it was Dalton, Georgia. And had to drive from Nashville. And when they put together the schedule, Murfreesboro, had to play at 8 a.m., which would be 7 a.m. Nashville time or Murfreesboro time. So how early do you think they had to get up? Very, very early. And I remember Nashville, the Nashville B team, you probably knew I'd be on the B team, but the B team, when we didn't play it a little bit later. And I remember we got there, it was halftime of that first game. And poor little old Murfreesboro was playing the Chattanooga A team. That was, you talk about a mismatch. And I remember it was halftime and I saw the assistant and he came up to me and said, look at that scoreboard. And I don't remember the exact score, but it was something like 50-5 or something like that. He said, I got up at 4:30 in the morning for this, but he wasn't mad about it because he wanted to be a part of these things. So it's so easy sometimes to feel like, oh, just send them away. I'm just tired. Let's look at Mark chapter 5. We looked at Mark chapter 6 with the feeding of the 5,000. But Mark chapter 5, here's an example that happened just before this, basically. And in verse 21 of Mark 5, when Jesus then had crossed over again by boat to the other side, a great multitude, all these people following him. And wanting to hear him, to see him, to be healed, all these things. A great multitude gathered to him. He was by the sea. Behold, one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus by name, when he saw him, he fell at his feet. He begged him earnestly, my little daughter lies at the point of death. Please come and lay your hands on her that she may be healed and she'll live. So Jesus went with him. Great multitude followed him. They even thronged him. You can just see all these people. Now, a certain woman, she had a flow of blood for 12 years. She had suffered many things. And she had spent all that she had on the doctors and so forth. She was no better, but rather grew worse. So who knows what kind of help they knew back then. So when she heard about Jesus, she came up behind him. In the crowd, she touched his garment. She said, if only I could just touch his clothes, I'll be made well. And immediately the flow of the blood was dried up. She felt her body, and she was healed of the affliction. Jesus, immediately knowing in himself that power had gone out of him, turned around and said, who touched my clothes? And he looked around to see her who had done this thing. Did he chastise her? No. He encouraged her. But they're all thronging him. Well, soon after this, we see this feeding the 5,000. Do you think he may have gotten tired at times? Think he may Watch how tired the disciples were at times. Turn over to Mark 8. Mark chapter 8. What is Mark chapter 8? Well, my Bible has a little heading before each chapter. It says the feeding of the 4,000. So here he does it again. The feeding of the 4,000. Similar to the feeding of the 5,000, but a separate incident. And notice, after all this, you see this healing, you see the feeding of the 5,000, feeding of the 4,000. Drop it down to verse 10 of this chapter. And immediately he got into the boat, got into the boat again, and his disciples, they came to the region of Dalmanutha. And the Pharisees, they came out and began to dispute with him. They were seeking a sign from heaven, testing him. Don't you think he got tired of hearing them test him? In fact, he sighed deeply in his spirit. And he said, why does this generation seek another sign? Assuredly, I say to you, no sign should be given to this generation. Of course, the Jonah, he says that in another spot. And he left them, he got in the boat, and he departed to the other side. Now the disciples had forgotten to take bread, and they didn't have more than one loaf with them in the boat. So he charged them, saying, take heed, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. And they reasoned among themselves, saying, it must be because we have no bread. He had just fed 4,000 people. Jesus, being aware of them, said, why do you reason because there's no bread? Do you not yet perceive? Don't you understand? Is your heart still hardened? When I broke the 5 loaves for the 4,000, how many baskets full of fragments did I take up? And they said, well, 12. He said, when I broke the 7 for the 4,000, how many large bags of fragments did I take up? And they said, 7. And then he said to them, how is it that you still don't understand? It's not about feeding people. It's about Jesus Christ performing miracles. Being a Christian means we get tired in the summer heat of our life of conversion. It's easy to say, send them away. We just want to rest. But you don't rest as a Christian, do you? Now, you need to pace yourself, of course. Now, Johann Sebastian Bach was one of the great musicians of all times. He wrote hundreds, possibly even thousands, of musical pieces. He was the musician for the emperor. Now, much of Johann Sebastian Bach's works have been lost. You know, when he would write these pieces, he would write it on these parchment paper that was used to pack meat and fish in ice. So a lot of his pieces just got thrown away and lost. But one thing he did for the pieces they have, and every piece of music he ever wrote, whether it was sacred or religious or secular, he did something on everyone, on almost every manuscript that's ever been found. Bach placed 2 sets of initials, one at the front and one at the back. At the very front, he had the letter JJ, and at the very back, he had SDG. JJ at the beginning and SDG at the end. JJ stood for Jesus Help Me. And SDG stood for to God Alone Be the Glory. Every piece of music he ever wrote. Now, Bach was a human being. He wasn't, but it was interesting. We could do worse than assign these words to our everyday life. Jesus, help me, because don't we all need help? And to God be the glory. Now, there was a hospital I used to call on in Chattanooga, Tennessee, Memorial Hospital. It's a Catholic hospital. But on one of the elevators, they had a little plaque, very small. It was not one of the major elevators. It was one sort of a elevator to get up to the surgical central supply that I have to go to. And it had a little, small little plaque, and it just said, have you thanked God for life today? Have you thanked God for life today? And every time I would see that, I would think, yeah, have I? So as you and I, and I'll finish this next time I speak. I have a split sermon in January, about probably January, the fall and the winter. But as we've entered or will enter the summer of our Christian life, it's so easy to get tired, so easy to feel tired, so easy to say, just send them away. Let me alone. And we do need to pace ourselves. But it doesn't mean it's time. It's time to keep pushing forward, isn't it? And realize how blessed we are to have life. How blessed we are to have life. It means doing a work and living life worthy of the calling that you and I have been called to live. And I saw this prayer written out. I don't know where I saw this. So who knows who wrote it? Probably wasn't even a true Christian. But I just thought I would read this as we close. It says, here's a prayer to God somebody wrote out. It says, we're nothing without you, O Lord. And it's hard to be something when one is nothing. It's hard to keep moving. Hard to keep pumping. Hard to keep giving out. But we have you. It says, come back to our lives in strength. Renew the spirit within us. Give us bread for our wilderness. For you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. So let's you and I consider the spring of our conversion, a time of learning to wait on the kingdom, the patience of the second phase, the summer, of the patience needed for the long haul. And the summer of our life, finding the strength to serve. The life of a Christian, in some ways, nothing parallels exactly, but in many ways, I think the life of a Christian parallels the four seasons of the year.